today on the 21st.
You may see on the internet or on TV about, you know, we can reduce your student loans. We can get your student loans forgiven.
But that's not always true. We speak with Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan about her efforts to combat student debt fraud and the ongoing investigation into the companies that offer student loans. And when it comes to weather alerts, out with the old.
At 1 p.m. in Bloomington, skies were partly sunny.
And in with the new.
At 1 p.m. in Peoria, skies were mostly sunny.
Plus, a conversation about college students and the startling research that half of community college students struggle with food insecurity. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As Illinois college students head back to their campuses this week, we wanted to start the show spending a few minutes talking about student loan debt. It's tripled to a whopping $1.2 trillion over the past decade. Earlier this week, Senator Dick Durbin and State Attorney General Lisa Madigan called on federal lawmakers to do something about this. They're again proposing a federal student loan borrower bill of rights. Joining us to talk about that effort and what she's trying to do to prevent fraud in the student loan industry in Illinois is State Attorney General Lisa Madigan. Attorney General, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
What would this bill of rights contain? What do student loan borrowers need to know now and be protected by and that they're not? That's not happening.
So here's what we've seen, and unfortunately, it's very reminiscent of what we saw during the mortgage foreclosure crisis when homeowners were struggling to stay in their homes. They were turning to their banks to try to get some sort of a modification so they could continue making payments on their mortgages, and they got this really, you know, disinterested and unhelpful treatment that ultimately resulted in many, many people losing their homes who probably didn't have to. Well, now what we're seeing is very similar with student borrowers who have an enormous amount of debt, are really struggling to pay it off. And when they turn to their servicer and they're asking, what are my options? What can I do to make this more affordable? Unfortunately, they're not being told about their options. They're not being told about income-based repayment programs. They're not being told about consolidation. They're not being told specifically what's the best thing that you could do for your circumstances. And so one of the major things that this Bill of Rights would do is require the servicer to actually go through on an individual basis and tell the borrower what they should do to make their loan more affordable so as to prevent them from going into default and not being able to pay on their loan at all.
Now, speaking of that, as Attorney General, Illinois led a multi-state investigation into Sallie Mae, now known as Navient Corp., alleging that they're the nation's largest student loan company, that there are some reports that they violated state laws on unfair or abusive practices in these calls with borrowers who are trying to refinance. And at least that's according to some news reports that I saw earlier this year about what you all have uncovered in this investigation. What's the latest with that?
So you are correct in that my office is leading a nationwide investigation into Navient, formerly Sallie Mae. They are the largest of the loan servicers that are out there. So a servicer is the entity that the borrower is making their monthly payments to. And we started this because a few years ago, we started getting an increasing number of complaints from borrowers saying that not just were their loan amounts large, but their interactions with Navient were going very poorly. They weren't getting information they needed. They were in circumstances where they had done one thing based on what they'd been told to do, but ultimately that didn't help them. And so we saw a series of problems, and it wasn't just with struggling borrowers. So it wasn't just with people who were having a hard time making their payments. It included individuals who were current on their payments and, in fact, were trying to overpay, put more money toward paying down their loan every month. Those payments we were seeing were being misapplied. They weren't following instructions that the borrowers were giving them. Again, with the struggling students, borrowers, they weren't getting information on their repayment options. Instead, they were being put into what are known as forbearances because it was a very quick thing for the servicer to do, but ultimately that would only increase the amount of the loan that the borrower would have to pay in the long run. In addition, we were seeing problems and getting complaints about the debt collection side of it. So when somebody was in default and they were, you know, trying to get that money from them, kind of the same tactics that are being used, kind of the abusive debt collection practices where they're calling you, you know, multiple times a day, they're calling you at work even though you've told them to stop doing that. And so we opened an investigation, have looked through thousands of complaints, have listened to hundreds of recordings of phone calls that borrowers had with the servicer, and we really have seen a wide range of problems that absolutely need to stop. At this point, if a servicer is doing their job properly, there are so many options available that you should be able to avoid a borrower going into default.
Have you all proposed terms for legal settlement with Navient? Are you there yet?
We are in the midst of trying to work on what I would call a set of servicing standards. Again, very similar to what we did during the mortgage foreclosure crisis with the mortgage lenders and servicers, saying, look, this is what you have to do with every single borrower that comes to you. And our goal would be to put that in place, not just for Navient and not just for the other servicers of federal student loans, but also with private student loans, because people who have to take out private loans are facing very similar problems and oftentimes have even fewer options available to them in terms of affordable repayment.
I'm speaking with Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan. Attorney General, what about student loan debt relief scams? I know this is something your office has, especially this time of year, put a lot of work and effort into. What do students or any others, holders of student loan, what do they need to be wary of?
You need to be wary of not getting the information you need directly from your servicer and therefore, you know, falling or being lured by, I should say, these promises that you hear on the radio, not on your station, but you hear on other stations or you may see on the internet or on TV about, you know, we can reduce your student loans. We can get your student loans forgiven. Just call us for, you know, a free assessment. Call us for free advice. Well, when you call, really all they're trying to do is take a large amount of money from you up front. They oftentimes are really doing nothing for you that you cannot do for yourself that is not already a free federal program. Yet because this lack of information has been given to borrowers, they're oftentimes turned into these scam artists. So far, we have sued 8 different operations that are engaged in this type of behavior. We're working to resolve all of those cases. I think we've resolved about 6 of them. We've got 2 more to resolve, and there are more investigations that are ongoing. So you need to know, in Illinois, if somebody tells you that they can help you reduce your debt, whether it's your student loan debt or it's your credit card debt or they can help you on a mortgage modification, it's actually illegal for them to take money from you up front to do that. That is, again, illegal. It is the red flag of a scam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And to that end, where are we at with federal efforts that would make refinancing student loan debt nationally easier?
So there is a bill that was proposed by Senator Elizabeth Warren. I know it is supported by Senator Durbin and many other good senators at the United States level that are hoping to pass. So in a similar manner that homeowners are able to refinance their mortgages, we would allow individuals who hold student loan debt to refinance. We see people coming to us whose student loans are, you know, over 15% interest rate. And the idea would be, right, really high. The idea would be, look, right now we're seeing some, you know, historically low interest rates. Students should be able to take advantage of that to reduce the overall amount they have to pay. And it doesn't just benefit them. And this is another thing people need to understand. It doesn't just benefit the student borrower, but it also benefits our overall economy. Because what we have now is people recognize are, you know, almost a generation of people who are seriously looking at the option once they get out of college, moving back in with their families. So they're not renting apartments. They're not purchasing cars. They're not starting families. They're not buying furniture. I mean, there's a whole, you know, series of things that are impacted when people don't have the resources to do anything except pay down their student loan debt.
Given all of that, one last question for you. What advice do you have for students in college now? How should they be thinking about student loans?
Well, you need to be very careful about how much money you take out. And the best thing for people to do, you know, preferably before they start college, is to really sit down and determine, you know, what type of a degree do you want? What type of a credential do you need? Where can I go that is, you know, the lowest priced option, or at least an option, you know, that I can afford and understand what the implication of that loan is going to be in the long run? Unfortunately, and this is not a surprise, you know, teenagers aren't necessarily understanding that, hey, at the end of the day, this is going to be $30,000 of debt. This is going to be $60,000 of debt. It's going to be $120,000 of debt, and what that means in terms of paying that back and the type of salary you have to earn at a job. So any work you can do on the front end to understand that is obviously helpful. If you're already in school, you know, make sure you're not taking out a whole series of loans that you may not ultimately need, because paying them back is very expensive to do. And so you just have to really go in eyes wide open when you take out student loans.
Lisa Madigan is Illinois' Attorney General, joining us from Chicago. It sounds like, judging by the siren, right? Attorney
General. Yeah, there you go. There's always something going on outside.
Right. Okay. Thanks very much. I appreciate the time.
You know what? You're very welcome. And let me just say one more thing to you, that we actually have a student loan helpline, because we've had so many people call us, and it's so confusing, and people are not getting the information that they need from their loan servicer. And so we actually have trained a group of counselors who can, you know, help you sort through what's out there, what you can do, so that you're not, you know, again, falling prey to scam artists, or just, you know, not doing anything and ending up in default.
And I'm assuming that's available for free, that service that you're providing.
That is available for free. Obviously, your taxpayer dollars go to support the people that are doing the work, but yes, overall, that is yes, you do not have to pay when you call them. And so you can go on our website. We've got information there, which is IllinoisAttorneyGeneral.gov, and that student loan helpline is 800-455-2456.
Student loan debt isn't the only problem college students are facing as they start school this fall. By the way, we'll tweet out all of those links that the Attorney General mentioned if you follow 21st Show. When we think of Americans struggling with hunger, we tend to think of small children or families. But as recent research has found, the issue stretches beyond the confines of grade school. A study published by University of Wisconsin researchers shows that close to half of community college students struggle with food insecurity, meaning not having enough reliable access to affordable and nutritious food. Similar problems exist at four-year schools. It's something that Michael Gillespie sees in his classroom. He teaches at Eastern Illinois University in the sociology department. He joins us on the phone now from Charleston. Michael Gillespie, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here to talk about this issue.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've said that your experience teaching and volunteering in food pantries in your area, I know you've seen the physical toll that it takes on students. Can you describe to me what you see sometimes among your student population?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the physical signs that we see with college students mirrors what we would see with younger children in their elementary and middle school and high school classrooms, often being distracted, having a hard time concentrating, being irritable, in short, looking tired often, not coming to class prepared. And sometimes we see these signs as sort of an apathy or a level of disinterest, but a lot of times there's things happening underneath in their personal lives, including not getting enough nutrition, enough good food into their body. And a couple years ago, I started noticing this with my students, especially around the end of the semesters when maybe financial aid is starting to run out, or their swipes for their meals and the dining halls are starting to run out. And some of our top students were just really struggling within our department. And I had a couple candid conversations with them, and they basically said things like, well, you know what, I haven't eaten in 2 days because I don't have any food and I can't get to the store, or I don't have access. And so we really started putting an effort towards addressing those issues here on campus and within the community.
Michael, it must be really tough, because all of the things that you're describing are very typical issues that college students face if they seem tired or they're overworked or they're stressed out. How do you get to the point? I wonder how you are able to even broach the subject of having that candid conversation, because that must be a difficult thing to do and a delicate issue, I imagine.
It is a delicate issue, and it's a delicate issue not just with college students, but across most adults who have a, you know, we kind of live in a a society that has that sort of independent spirit and pride, and to humble yourself and ask for help for these things is often hard, and it's really hard when you have a student population who's really trying to find their way and trying to make it and trying to do that. Fortunately, I have a reputation on campus as being the professor who studies poverty and who's really interested in these issues, and I've been doing a lot of speaking out, and so I think that I have that rapport where students know that I care and that I can do this, which isn't to say that it's not always the case with a lot of other professors, but I feel like I present myself as a safe space, which is, the non-judgmental, willing to help, offering, kind of doing things on the down low sometimes, whether it's, slipping a food card into a paper that you're handing back to a student, or just a little note that says, hey, if you need help, let me know, sending emails, those sorts of things.
And I imagine, do you find that most students are hesitant to ask for help?
Absolutely. Yeah, very hesitant to ask for help.
So, and how do you manage that? As you said, you just sort of, you have to then be, do you think that oftentimes professors or other people in the community have to be the one to offer help because people won't ask for it?
Oftentimes, yes. So just make it available or make it known. We put up flyers. I started a little sort of food pantry snack shelf in my office so that when students come in and ask for help on other things, I can say, hey, do you need a snack? You need some food? Things like that. Just to like put yourself out there. A lot of times, we're not willing to ask for help, but if there's an opportunity presented where the asking is more of a, hey, here's this resource for you, it often, at least in my and my experience, tends to be much more beneficial and used much more effectively than not.
We're speaking with Michael Gillespie. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about college campuses, college students, hunger. We're going to be talking to a couple folks from food pantries at universities and continuing the conversation with Michael and another researcher. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the problem of hunger on college campuses. We've been speaking with Michael Gillespie, who studies poverty and actually deals with this firsthand in the sociology department at Eastern Illinois University. I also want to bring someone else into the conversation, Professor Sarah Goldwick Robb. She's the head researcher of the University of Wisconsin study that we referenced earlier. She's now at Temple University in Philadelphia. As always, if you have questions or comments and want to join our conversation we're having on air, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Michael, SIU just announced last week that they're opening a food pantry, and it was prompted in part by research from 2013 that polled students from SIU, from Western, from Eastern, and NIU. 35% of students who responded to that survey said they had problems with getting food regularly, and that's why Southern Illinois University in Carbondale is opening up this food pantry this semester.
Yep.
I should mention we're going to be joined by coordinators from food pantries at the University of Illinois and Parkland Community College and NIU later in the hour. But I wanted to ask you, Michael, do we have a sense of how big a problem this is on Illinois campuses?
Based on the four campuses that were part of that study, those were all in that research that was done. It's that 35% or so, and it varies by campus, and a lot of that has to do with living on campus, off campus, who the demographic of students are, and displacement and those sorts of things. But I would say across the state, I think that 35% is a really good estimate.
Wow. Is that for someone who works in poverty, do you find that number surprising, that 35% of college students, and or around that figure, obviously, because it's 35% of people who responded to the poll, 35% of college students may have problems having access to food regularly that's healthy and that they can afford?
Unfortunately, it does not surprise me, especially in some of the areas where these schools are at. I know here in Coles County, where Eastern Illinois University is at, it's one of the poorest counties in the region, if not the state. And so there's lots of other impacts and factors that go along with how the students on campus, whether they live on campus or off campus, the types of jobs and things to be able to afford even those healthful meals. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that it's so high.
We know there's national research published by the University of Wisconsin late last year showing that close to half of community college students struggle with food insecurity. One of those researchers is on the line with us now. Sarah Goldwick Robb is now at Temple University in Philadelphia. Sarah, can you tell us how your research came about?
Well, you know, in some ways, listening to Michael talk, this sounds very familiar because I also had students in my classroom who were sometimes doing things like not paying attention or falling asleep. And when I did explore with them what was going on in their lives, they found many of the same sorts of things that he's describing. But it was also the case that I had a research team that starting in 2008 was in the field talking to undergraduates across the state of Wisconsin at 42 different public colleges and universities. And we were asking them how college was going. We were interested in the challenges they were having in paying for college in particular, but we were still surprised when people said things like, I have trouble getting enough to eat. What is your main challenge in college? Food. I wish I didn't have to focus on not having food all the time. If I could focus on school rather than finding food, that would help me. That's how it started to come up. And from there, we've really built a multi-pronged research agenda around this issue.
What are the biggest factors you found, Sarah, that lead to food insecurity for college students?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one is that people grew up food insecure. So, you know, once upon a time, people who grew up with a substantial amount of poverty, you know, and particularly persistent poverty in their lives, they didn't attend college. You know, they didn't finish high school, to be honest with you. These days, high school graduation rates are up and college-going rates are up. There's more of a push for everyone to go to college because it's hard to do anything if you don't go to college. And so we have a greater representation among college students of people who grew up, for example, getting the free and reduced price lunch program in elementary school. But it's not just that there are more people from low-income families in college today. It's also, and again, very much aligned with what Michael was saying, it is also the case that the price of attending college is higher than ever before, and the ability of students and their families to cover those costs, including through good, well-paying jobs, is more limited than ever before. So there are also, frankly, fairly middle-class folks who are falling short.
I wanted to ask you about that, Sarah. And Michael, I'd love for you to chime in after Sarah answers. What are the demographics we're seeing among college students? Is this a problem that cuts across, you mentioned socioeconomic, but does this also cut across racial lines as well?
It certainly does. And I do want to note that we have done surveys at both community colleges and at public four-year institutions, very much like those you're describing in Illinois, and it certainly cuts across those sectors as well. It also, we know, is happening even at very elite institutions, including places like Harvard University.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly cutting across racial lines. It's cutting across gender lines. You know, I have a sense that the only people who are, you know, safely exempt from it are those probably in the top 25% of the income distribution or something like that. This can happen, and it can be a short-term thing, or it can be a persistent problem while people are trying to get an education.
Michael?
And I absolutely agree with everything, and this includes even students who have jobs on or off campus, full-time, part-time, raising families. It's not discriminatory of any social group. It is cutting across all of these different lines.
Thanks for that. That's Michael Gillespie. He's in the sociology department at Eastern Illinois University. I wanted to bring two more people into this conversation, and there are people who are working with this issue directly. Katie Thomas is in studio with me. She's the director of the Wesley Food Pantry in Urbana. There's a branch at Parkland Community College in Champaign as well. Katie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me. And on the line with us from Northern Illinois University, Liz Mickey runs the Huskies Food Pantry there at NIU. Liz, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. It's good to be on the phone with you all.
Katie, how much are students, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the pantry and what types of students you see, where it is, how students know about it.
Sure. Our pantry on campus, it was started by a very wonderful employee, sort of out of the goodness of her heart in 2014. And as it was expanding, she came to the university, and it became a university initiative a month and a half ago. So I've learned a lot about, we've been doing a lot in terms of moving it from the off-campus location to on-campus. So right now it's in our old rec center, and we've been working with a lot of our facilities management to renovate the space to make sure it meets health code and things like that. Currently our usership is about 86% undergraduate students, and then 78% of our usership are non-traditional students. So those are our students who might be working full-time, have families, anything that you would use to qualify a non-traditional student. We're still, since it came from off-campus and now to on-campus, we aren't sure what our full population is, but I've heard you all talking about the 35% across the board. And we've not seen as that many students come through our pantry, but just based on the number, it has increased since it became a university-recognized initiative. I'm interested to see what our total percent of our population will look like here.
Liz, when did you all move on campus?
June.
Okay. And what precipitated that?
So the pantry was housed in a religious facility, and it was growing. And the religious facility politely gave them a year to find a new space so they could have their worship space back. And so that was when the employee came to the university and said, you know, this is a need for our students, and we should really be supporting it. And we jumped on board with it.
That's Liz McGee. She runs the Huskies Student Food Pantry up in DeKalb at Northern Illinois University. Katie Thomas, where are the pantries that are located at U of I?
Okay. Well, the Wesley Food Pantry's location is at Parkland College, and we opened back in 2013. And that was prompted because students were going to student services, the Dean of Student Services, and letting them know that they were struggling with food. And so we opened that about 3 years ago now. And I wanted to address your question about the type of students that we're seeing. And, you know, you would be surprised. So about a year ago, we had an athletics coach bring in his entire team to tell him about the food pantry because he was hearing from his student athletes that they did not have enough food to eat. And sure enough, we continued seeing some of those student athletes attending. I even recognized a couple students myself just from pictures like, oh, wow, those are student athletes. You know, we think of these students as being fit, strong, healthy. Surely they have enough to eat. And no, you know, that is not always the case. We are actually going to be opening student-only hours for University of Illinois students on our on-campus location starting in September. So we will be serving them once a month. And that was prompted from our own informal survey that we did of University of Illinois students, where about 20% of those who respond to our survey said that they experienced some degree of food insecurity. And that number rose when we asked them if they knew of friends who had experienced food insecurity, and that went up to 30%. 5% had already used our food pantry on campus. And another 30% of those surveyed said that they would access a food pantry if it was a student-only pantry on campus. And one of the things that we found in the study was that a lot of the students were wary of taking away resources from community members because, you know, students aren't supposed to be hungry. So they didn't want to take away food from others who were
more needy. So they wouldn't go to a community food pantry because
right.
They thought those people really need it?
Right, and not them. Mm-hmm.
And how does your food pantry work, Katie? Is it just like a normal, like a kind of a normal off-campus food pantry? What kind of food do you have available?
So at our Parkland College location, that is directly on campus. So it's very easily accessible to the students. It is open to the public. And we're finding something like 15 to 25% of the clients who are attending are students. And we serve a variety of food. You know, it's a lot of the food that you would expect at a food pantry. So, you know, your canned food, your boxed food. But we also try to make a special effort to have food that is easy to use for students. So like the microwavable oatmeal cups and fruit cups and other items like that. And, you know, we try our best to have fresh produce, dairy, other things like that. And actually, a student at the Parkland College started a produce plot to supply the food pantry with fresh produce during the summer and the fall.
Liz, how do you all communicate the word out in DeKalb or in the Rockford area for NIU students? How do they know that you're there?
So we're working on those lines right now. One thing that's been really good for us is we work with the Northern Illinois Food Bank, who has a sense of pantries in the area. So once a month, we meet with those pantries. And we all have a sort of different segment of the population that we work with specifically, although we do see crossover. So we're able to share that information. So if a student were to go to another pantry, they would be served but told about our pantry. We're sort of doing an unveiling of ours. It's still not renovated completely yet, so we don't want to say it's open and it's not quite all the way open. We're doing some pop-up pantries for our students in the meantime, but we're going to unveil it hopefully in the next month. But we've been doing pop-up pantries for our students.
Liz, where do you get the food from?
The Northern Illinois Food Bank predominantly.
They predominantly. And Katie, what about you? Where do you get the food from?
Yes, the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
And do you find that the food banks are now sort of have an infrastructure of working with college campuses? Katie, has that been your experience?
Yes, it's certainly growing. I know that the Eastern Illinois Food Bank was looking at starting a community college pantry over in Vermilion County, for example. So there is a growing awareness, and they are definitely doing all they can to help us out as we have questions and try to better serve the student population.
Katie, we've heard so much over the past year about social service programs. In fact, we've had food pantries come on, talk about the state budget situation and how that's affected what they do. Has the state budget situation and a lack of funding to different social service agencies affected you all in your food pantry here in the Champaign-Urbana area?
Well, specifically the Wesley Food Pantry, we haven't been affected insofar as that the majority of our funding does come from individual donations. That is the vast majority. So we weren't receiving any state funding. The way that it is affecting us is simply that we're seeing an increase in clients attending the food pantry, clients letting us know how they've had different social services cut off from them, and that is, you know, making it harder on their budgets. And we're seeing more clients at our food pantry, so our food costs have been increasing.
Well, I even wonder if students worried about their MAP grant funding, if they're also trying to save money, that's been an issue. I don't know if students have said that to you, Katie?
Yeah, certainly we've seen that, particularly at Parkland. You know, well, they haven't necessarily said, oh, well, it's the lack of MAP funding, but you know, we have students who say that, well, we have all these fees to pay. We have to pay for, you know, tuition because of the lack of funding. And that's why we're seeing them at the food pantry. So, yes, it certainly has been an effect.
Liz, we just have about a minute left before we have to take a break. How are you all affected by the state budget situation? Is that affecting you all?
Yeah, we just met up with financial aid last week to really understand. They see a lot of the students who come to the pantry and refer the students to our pantry. And we have a nice percentage of our students who rely on that MAP grant. So I know even personally interacting with our students, they've been very concerned about how to cover that gap. And so the pantry is one way to help. It's a small way, but it's definitely impacting our students in terms of paying for food, for their books, for everything.
And is NIU at all equipped to help you out if need be? Are there resources from the university standpoint for you, Liz?
They've provided the space for us, and they're covering the cost of renovation, and we're working on those funding lines right now, looking for donors to support internships and student learning through the pantry.
Thanks for that. That's Liz McKee. She's the director of the Husky Student Food Pantry at NIU. I want to thank also Katie Thomas, who's the director of the Wesley Food Pantry. As she said, there's a branch opening at the U of I. They have a branch at Parkland Community College as well. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. And I should note, we're also compiling a list of food pantries on college campuses across Illinois, as well as information about SNAP benefits. We're going to be talking about that coming up on the 21st, but it's all at our website, www.21stshow.org. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about college students and hunger. My guest is Sarah Goldrick-Robb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She was formerly at the University of Wisconsin, where she published the research we've been talking about all this hour on The 21st. Sarah, I think one question people who are listening to this might think is, why aren't college students eligible for food stamps? And it's my understanding that that may be, that's not as easy as it seems like it might be, right?
No, it's definitely not. I mean, I think that there's a one larger question that they might want to ask themselves, which is, why is it that even though we understand the importance of nutrition to learning, to higher order skills, right? Why is it that we understand that we provide those supports during elementary and secondary education, and then we abruptly end those supports during post-secondary education? Because it isn't just about food stamps. I mean, one of the reasons that these food pantries are open is also that the free and reduced price lunch program, the National School Lunch Program, which provides breakfast and lunch, is also not operational at colleges and universities, even at community colleges. And food stamps, they are technically available, but they have a work requirement. And it's 20 hours a week. And unfortunately, the decision has been that college doesn't count towards the work requirement. So for a person in college to receive food stamps, they have to work 20 hours a week, at least on top of going to college, which is demonstrably counterproductive to the completion and especially the timely completion of their degree.
So, Sarah, it sounds like you would advocate for the free and reduced lunch program to be extended to the collegiate level.
Absolutely. And in fact, my team has made that proposal and had some success. In fact, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Bobby Scott from Virginia, went ahead and introduced exactly our proposal into the Child Nutrition Act during the most recent hearings. Now, this is at a time when they're trying to cut all support of this form, so it didn't go anywhere at this point. But he made clear, and of course we expected it not to go anywhere, but he made clear that he'll be bringing it up again during the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. So I do think this is something that, in addition to pulling money out of our own pockets and providing meal cards to students and opening food pantries, that colleges and universities and the public needs to be working on, which are much larger, more systemic policy changes so that students don't have to fall through the cracks in this way so often.
Sarah, I'm just thinking about what other policy changes you think that could help solve this systemically. And I can't help but think of the beginning of the hour speaking to the Illinois Attorney General about student loans and about student loan debt. I mean, do you see that as the biggest other systemic problem here? What other policy changes would you like to see to help address the issue of having college students no longer be going hungry?
Right. So debt isn't the problem. Debt is a symptom of the problem. The problem is that college is completely unaffordable for the vast majority of families in this country, and that that's true even in the most seemingly inexpensive places like America's community colleges. And it's expensive at precisely the time when people need college more than ever, and they have less money than ever to spend on it. And so that is what's leading to student loan debt. That's why people are borrowing so much money and having trouble repaying it. That is why students are not finishing college in the time that they should be. Four-year degrees are no longer. It is why students are going without the housing and food that they need in order to learn. We've made college far too expensive, and people are really paying the price.
Besides colleges setting up food pantries for students, what else do you think can be done on a small scale to help this solve this problem immediately?
Well, yeah, I have a new book that's going to be released in a couple of weeks. And one of the main messages of this book called Paying the Price is that we have to really take this problem seriously. I mean, the first thing that has to happen is that a lot more faculty and staff and people working at colleges need to really listen to your guest, Michael. They need to listen to what he's saying, which is that he starts by believing the student that there's a problem, by listening to them and acknowledging that it's possible that they're not merely lazy or not trying to do well in school, but that they might really be up against a significant challenge that's a recognized problem out there, and starting to come up with ways of addressing it. But so many of the students going through these things are unwilling and unable to say anything about it because they're treated as if they've done something wrong, that it's a moral failing. And by starting to acknowledge that financial constraints or poverty is not a moral failure and is instead, in some cases, a temporary blockade holding people back from achieving the American dream, that would be a major step forward.
Sarah, last question for you. Do you think the biggest part of this problem is that the general public doesn't understand this? Forget colleges and administrators or professors. Do you think that people don't even recognize that this is an issue, that college students, that many, as you know, as much as a third or maybe more college students are having these problems?
I certainly do think that's one aspect of it. We have a very stereotypical version of undergraduates in our heads when we think about college. We're thinking about very young people. We're assuming that they're supported by the parents while they're in college. And we continue to think that the price of college is reasonable. And none of those things are true. Only 13% of undergraduates live on college campuses. And yet you hear all of this talk about dormitories and meal plans, et cetera. We talk all about family support when in fact, a huge number of students are supporting their own children while they're in college. And even young people are actually supporting their parents while they go to school. So updating our image and expectations of today's college students would be a big step forward.
That's Sarah Goldwick-Robb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. Sarah, thank you for being with us.
I appreciate you having me.
As I've mentioned before, we've compiled a list of food pantries on college campuses throughout Illinois, as well as information about SNAP benefits. It's all up on our website at www.21stshow.org. Whenever there's an emergency, severe weather, amber alerts, or other warnings, for years, this is the voice we've heard on radio and TV.
In Bloomington, skies were partly sunny. The temperature was 78 degrees. The dew point was 66. And the relative humidity was 66%.
That's perfect, Paul, a computerized message system from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. This summer, Paul got an upgrade. Let's call him Paul 2.0.
At 1 p.m. in Peoria, skies were mostly sunny. The temperature was 84 degrees, the dew point was 63, and the relative humidity was 49%.
Chris Gilhart is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service. He helped install the new Paul, and he joins us on the phone from Lincoln in central Illinois. Chris, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me here.
Chris, first, where did people hear Paul? Can you remind us when they would hear Paul?
Most of the time, they would hear them on a NOAA weather radio receiver that they would happen to have in their home. However, the voices do appear occasionally on regular radio and TV stations as part of the emergency alert system.
And is this voice based on an actual person?
Yes, it is. It recorded several different sound clips of individual pronunciations of consonants and vowels and words, and then it was able to splice them all together to make a more natural-sounding voice.
Wow. How long did it take you guys to do that? How long have you been working on this?
In our office, we had it installed just after the 4th of July, and it took us probably about 12 hours or so to go through the system and make sure it has all the words correctly pronounced for this local area.
Well, I was wondering about that with the pronunciations. I'm thinking, like, did you have to teach Paul how to say Cairo or Chillicothe? Like, how did that work with all of the different, I guess we could say, unusual place names that we have throughout our state?
Yes, that was mainly the big trouble that we had was trying to go through making sure that we had every single word correct to the point that we could. You know, like you mentioned, places like Cairo or Athens, towns like that you would think are pronounced differently, and they usually are in different parts of the country. But so here, using like a standardized dictionary for national purposes, it wouldn't necessarily work. So we went through and we tested pretty much every single town within about a 120-mile radius of here to make sure it sounded correct. and we would go through and change the individual inflections or the whether it was a long or a soft vowel or things like that to make sure it sounded correct.
And how do you all actually have to input the pronunciation? So, for example, if it's Cairo, do you actually have to sort of change a pronouncer in Paul's, I guess, computing system to learn how to do that?
Yes, we did. There was a specialized dictionary that came with the system, and we would put the word in. We test it out to see how it sounded, and if that didn't work correctly, then we would change some of the inflections or the pronunciation of the long or soft vowels, like on a syllable-by-syllable basis in that word to make sure it came to the point where it was close, at least close, if not correct.
Now, is this something that the National Weather Service, it sounds like you all used a voice for this. I don't know if Paul's voice is used throughout other states. Does the National Weather Service use different voices for different states?
Pretty much all the Weather Service offices use the same voice now. The exception is the female voice is used by Spanish-speaking weather radio stations.
Oh, interesting. So Paul is the English, so the male voice is the English-speaking voice and the female voice is the Spanish-speaking weather voice?
Correct. The female voice is Violeta. And there are a few offices, mainly across the southern part of the country, you know, like Arizona, Texas, down in that area, that would use it.
I mean, it's kind of, who comes up with the names, like Violeta or Paul? It's like, do the guys who get to create the storm name lists, like at the Hurricane Center, do some of these names get offloaded to the National Weather Service voice?
No, I believe the company that actually produced the new system is the one that actually came up with the names of the voice.
Mm-hmm. And have you guys, what kind of feedback have you guys gotten about this new voice?
Most of the feedback has been positive. There's been a few that have been concerned about some of the pronunciations not coming out correct. And sometimes that's a factor of we may have the original word correct, but in a phrase, it came out sounding a little off. So, like, for example, we had one where we're talking about Central Cass County, and Cass County by itself sounded okay, but when you put the word central in front of it, it sounded more like cuss. So then we had to go through and change that, but you know, things like that, it's really hard to test ahead of time. You know, we can't test every single word combination in the English language. So basically, as it comes up, we'll go through and fix it and make sure it sounds okay for the next time through.
And do people call and complain and say, hey, you said this name wrong?
Yes,
that's what happens at our public radio station. So I don't know if that happens to you, but we get lots of feedback.
Now, they've been doing that as long as I've been working for the Weather Service, and that was back when we were doing these manually. You know, you move to a new area, you don't necessarily know the pronunciations, and you were actually recording things to play back, and you don't realize that, you know, here Athens is pronounced with a long A instead of a short A.
When did you all switch electronic voice? I imagine that helps you out quite a bit significantly in terms of your workload, the Weather Service guys.
It does. We switched back in the late 1990s when the Weather Radio Network really started growing. We have 9 stations at our office individually operates, and that's really too much for one person even just to be dedicated only to doing that, try to keep everything up to date. So right now there's about 28 stations that cover the state, and all of them are able to input the data that we send out and immediately process it and play it on as many stations as it needs to. So that really cut down the amount of time that we needed to broadcast the information on. Just we went through this upgrade recently because we were still using some of the original equipment from the late 90s, and it was getting to be out of date, hard to get new parts for it, and things like that. So that's why we upgraded it.
And how long do you think this voice will last before another update?
I would think it would last for a number of years. I believe we do have, as part of the broadcast license, that if the company comes up with new upgrades, then they'll provide it to us, and we'll be able to implement it as they're deployed.
And Chris, obviously, this system kicks in when people really need information. Obviously, we have been having a lighthearted conversation about this, but it is really important when there's a weather emergency for you to get that information out. How important is it that people can understand every word that Paul says?
It's very critical, especially when you have people that are not familiar with the area. They don't necessarily know where all the little towns and things like that are. We have to make sure that they can understand the pronunciation of the town names for where they're going through know, what to be expected, because in many cases, you know, this is a very serious situation. They hear a warning, they need to take action quickly instead of just standing there trying to figure out, now what exactly did that just say?
Right.
Am I being impacted by it?
That's Chris Gilhart. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, helping introduce us to the new voices he says everyone needs to pay attention to when you hear it. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
That's all the time we have for today on the 21st. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about summer vegetables, taking your questions about those last vegetables that should be coming up. All of our information is all at our website at 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.